This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Welcome to Health and Living with me, T. Xiaoyik. Are you one of those people who's always anxious about being late? Or do you constantly feel that you're wasting your time and that you should be doing something more productive with your life instead? In an article on Psychology Today, Dr. Alex Lickerman wrote about his time anxiety. Will I feel when it comes to my time to die that I spent too much of my time frivolously? Now, that's a big question to explore. But also, I think on a sort of a more relatable daily basis, how much of this time anxiety affects us? You know, how do people experience it in different ways? And what can we do about it? Joining me to discuss this, Anum Sophia Mohammad Fazli, clinical psychologist from Thrive Well. Anum, thanks so much for joining me today. And I think it would be good to get a basic understanding of this term, time anxiety. It's the first I've heard of it, to be honest. Perhaps you can explain what it is.
So when we talk about time anxiety, it's actually, you know, like you said, it's actually pretty new, relatively speaking. And it's a very contemporary term. It's not even a clinical term, I would say. If we're talking about, you know, diagnosing people with anxiety. Even for me, as a clinical psychologist, when people ask me about time anxiety, the first time I heard about it, I was like, what is that? You know, so it's a very contemporary term. And I would say that it's almost like a pattern that we see now, that we have these new terms for different things, which encapsulate kind of the same thing. But in a way, when we talk about time anxiety, it basically means that we are having a lot of anxiety about the passing of time, right? When we look at the clock and we look at the time, we feel like we're wasting our time, or we're not doing enough, or we're worried about what's going to happen. Are we actually doing things that we're supposed to? So that is basically the summary of what we think about when we talk about time anxiety. And also, I think when I study through the time anxiety definition, they also talk about different types of time anxiety. There's different things like daily time anxiety, which means that person feels rushed from day to day. You know, they don't feel like they have enough time in a day. They also have this kind of tomorrow time anxiety, which means they're worried about the future. Are they able to do things tomorrow? Are they able to, I guess, meet certain goals in the future? And there's also this existential kind of anxiety, which just means that, you know, you're worried about your purpose. Basically, you're worried about whether or not you're doing things enough, whatever that you're doing now is enough for you to meet any kind of perceived purpose that you have. So all of this really talks about how we relate and ourselves to time, basically. Are we doing enough? Are we actually living enough? So a lot of people feel this type of freshness or this type of anxiety when we talk about time, passage of time.
And from your observations of working with clients, number one, are you seeing more people express this kind of anxiety? And number two, how do they come to you and express it, right? Because obviously they may not have vocabulary like daily time anxiety and all that. How does it manifest for them? What kinds of issues are they complaining to you about?
So for the first question, I think this time anxiety thing is very prominent, especially now in the modern world. I think nowadays we can see a lot more people, even though they don't have the language to describe it, they still see, you know, worrying about what they're doing. They worry they don't have enough time. And it's actually a very common thing when we talk about anxiety. In a way, there's always this kind of component when we talk about anxiety. For example, have anxiety disorders or any kind of anxiety, there's always some sort of time anxiety component to it. So it's almost like a package I would say. And I think when we talk about time anxiety as well, the way they would come and describe it is, you know, I feel, let's say they came into the session and they say, I feel like I'm not doing enough in my life. I feel like I'm just wasting my time. I'm always rushed to do something. I'm always worried that I'll be late. So those kind of things are a common complaint that when we look at it carefully, it's almost like they're worried that they don't have enough time and they cannot even look at the clock. Every time they look at the clock, they will, you know, have this kind of palpitation. They would feel like I'm not doing enough, right? So this is almost a way for us to understand, you know, these people or even myself. Sometimes that happens to me, even myself, when I have a lot of work to do. And when you look at the clock, you look at the time, you're just like, oh, what have I done today, right? So those kind of description or those kind of comments, you can see a lot of that when we talk about, if we want to relate it to time anxiety.
So I guess it's normal to experience that to some extent. We never would realistically have enough time to do a lot of things that we need to do. So I guess, you know, how much of it is normal? Because, you know, at the end of the day, we need that push to meet deadlines and to get tasks done, right? But at what point does it then become a problem? And what, you know, what drives people to then seek help from professionals like yourself for these issues?
You know, whenever people ask me, you know, what's normal, I always have difficulties just to understand even, you know, what is even normal nowadays. You know, everything is pushed to the boundaries, everything is changing. So what's normal yesterday may not be normal now, or what's not normal yesterday can be normal now. So there's always this change of how we perceive certain things. But I would say, Eric, say, if in my profession, when we talk about diagnosis, I'm just giving you an idea of how the diagnosis work, is that, you know, sometimes when we have certain worries or certain anxieties, if there's a certain threshold that we can see, for example, they cannot function at work anymore, they cannot function at home, they cannot socialize with people, and it's almost as if their function is totally gone because of this anxiety. They're crippled, basically, by their anxiety. So that's when it becomes a worry whether or not they can cope with it. So that's when they come for help. Mm. And most of the people, the push for them to actually, you know, I need to go to find help, I need to go to a psychiatrist, or I need to go to a therapist, is when they feel that, you know, their life is falling apart. Basically, they don't feel like they're able to function anymore at home. You know, some of my clients say they cannot even, you know, sleep anymore. And that really affects their life function. And I think this is one of the things that people think about when they go for a therapy. It's when they feel like they cannot cope with it alone anymore. And this is one of the things that I think help them make that decision to either go for a therapy or go for psychiatry. But I would say, for example, for me in this field, you don't have to be at that stage to ask for help. You know, you can just feel some kind of anxiety, and if you have the resources, then you can, you know, go and ask about certain things. You may find about new strategies, you may learn new things. Not even like not going for professional, you can just go ask a friend, for example, you know. So this kind of culture of asking for help may not be ingrained in our community yet, so that we kind of trying to do it ourselves, even though we don't have the best strategy, or we don't even ask for different opinions or different perspective. And this kind of like builds up until the point where, you know, everything's, like I said, you know, everything falls apart. And yeah, and this is where I see, you know, the reason why when people come to therapy, it's like that's the final point already.
Mm. Do you find that it could be because people are worried that they'll be seen as weak if they acknowledge or admit that they can't cope? And especially when it comes to something related to time and daily responsibilities, right? Where if you feel like you're not performing, you're going to be judged by people around you. Do you find that people are expressing that?
Yeah, totally. I think it's a complicated way of, okay, let's see, because for example, right, we hear a lot about stigma and say that, you know, people don't want to go for ask for help because of the stigma, right? I feel as if people would judge me, I would look weak. But it's not just that. The stigma comes from different things. And, you know, even as people, let's start with the person itself, themselves, right? So when we want to ask for help, that would mean that we don't know something or we have a lack of ability to do something, right? So some people, what happened is in their family, maybe they are raised to be that way, right? So they don't even know, okay, if you ask for help, then that means that you don't know and you got criticized for it. So that's the person level. Then you go up a little bit, you know, for example, at work. If you are saying that you're unable to do something, that would jeopardize your work. You know, some workplaces are very ruthless like that. And that can be another layer of, you know, perceived weakness. And even sometimes when we say, you know, going to friends, sometimes friends make comments like, you know, oh, you know, you cannot do even this. So it builds up. So it's not just that stigma of going for psychotherapy, because if you think about going for psychotherapy, then that means that you have exhausted all of the other resources and you need to go to psychotherapy. Then the thought would be, you know, I'm not able to do anything myself. No one can help me. So that's the stigma there, right? So you almost like you're a crazy person or you're unable to take care of yourself, because you go for a professional help. So it's like this chain of perception of different things that just cause this kind of unwillingness to ask for help, even though, you know, if you're sick, then you go to a doctor. That's totally normal. And I think that this is one of the reasons why people find it hard, because if I just simplify it as, you know, we just need to open up, you know, ask for help, there are a lot of things that comes with it, you know, with the work, with the social environment, with the family environment, with the person themselves. So usually this can be addressed in the therapy room as well. And even, you know, listening to this podcast, maybe a lot of people, you know, they can address it themselves, you know, what are the things that's stopping me actually, you know, is it feeling like I'm weak? So where does it come from? Is it, you know, something I learned from my family? Is it realistic? Is it something true? So just thinking about it can really help them, you know, make the best decision for themselves.
Absolutely. Let's continue this conversation when we come back from our break. I'm speaking to Anum Sophia Mohammad Fazli, clinical psychologist from Thrive Well, and we're discussing time anxiety. Is it a thing? Yes, it is. It's not a clinical term, but it does describe some feelings when people are struggling with issues like, you know, feeling rushed on a daily basis, feeling like they never have enough time and feeling pressured and stressed. It could even be anxiety over time that is yet to come. What's going to happen tomorrow or even on an existential basis. So we'll come back and continue this conversation. Stay tuned to us right here on Health and Living BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Health and Living with me, T. Xiao Ik, and my guest, Anum Sophia Mohammad Fazli, clinical psychologist from Thrive Well. We're discussing time anxiety. Now, even without knowing what this term is or what its definitions are, I'm sure that you would have experienced some form of it at one point or another in your life. And I think the issue is if you're experiencing it all the time and if you're feeling that it's disrupting your ability to function, to even do and feel well on a daily basis, that's where you want to be taking note of some of these red flags and to ask for help either from your support system around you or from a mental health professional. Anum, are there some behaviors that could suggest struggles with time anxiety where, you know, people might not realize that they're feeling anxious about this time component of their lives, but it's manifesting in behaviors that could be red flags? And I'm wondering whether procrastination, for instance, could be one of the red flags that might indicate, you know, the procrastination is not coming from laziness or those values, but it's actually because you're just so anxious that you can't even cope with tasks.
Yeah. So the interesting thing about procrastination is that everyone does it, without exception. Right? Whether it's a lot of procrastination or just a small amount, it depends on the person, but a lot of people, you know, do procrastinate. But the thing when we talk about, if we go back to the subject of time anxiety, one of there's two extremes to it. One of it is a person who's not able to relax if they're not doing something, right? They have to do something. And it's not just, you know, when we listen to our grandmothers or, you know, who are older, they say that I cannot just sit by, I have to do something. So they open a shop or they have an orchard or something. But this is more of a person who, you know, if they're at home, for example, they cannot even sleep. They think that sleep is a waste of time. They cannot even have a break, have lunch or have a meal. They feel like, you know, if I have a meal, then I'm wasting a lot of precious time that I should be doing something else, my task or my work. If you go to another extreme, is that you're totally crippled by your anxiety that you don't want to do anything. And this is actually a very common thing we see in people with anxiety, depression. You know, they have exhausted a lot of energy, you know, worrying about things that they end up not doing things, right? They worry about it, but they cannot do it. And I think we also have to remember that sometimes the procrastination is not just symptoms, but it can be the cause of certain types of anxiety. Some people, you know, let's just talk about the COVID situation, right? We have a lot of time, you know, to ourselves at home, for example. You know, some people are already used to that leisure amount of time they have for themselves, that now suddenly when they are tasked to do certain things, they procrastinate. And then when they procrastinate, they worry about the passage of time. And then when they worry about the passage of time, then suddenly they cannot do the task anymore because they're anxious about it. So there's a lot of that in between. So if we think about the behaviors that people that manifest when we talk about anxiety, is more or less that, right? The feeling of needing to rush. You're always rushing, you know, even if you hear your co-workers or your friends comment on, you know, you need to chill, you know, you need to relax. Then that would mean that you're very, very rushed about a lot of things, right? And not just a single thing, you know, you're not rushed just about your work, you're rushed about everything. Every single thing in your life, you know, I have to get home at this time, I have to sleep at this time, but even on your bed, you cannot sleep because you're thinking about work. And then there's this part of, you know, I cannot do anything anymore because if I do it, then I will not be doing it correctly because I have so much anxiety. So this is the kind of behaviors that I would say we see a lot of people who have this kind of worry in their life.
So I know you said time anxiety itself isn't a clinical disorder, but, you know, the kinds of challenges that you're describing do sound like they could fall into clinical anxiety. You know, so if somebody is experiencing these issues to such an extent, would they then be diagnosed with anxiety?
Okay, so when someone comes and they want to be, you know, they want to get a diagnosis or they want just want to have an idea of what's going on, there is a process of diagnosis. And just my thoughts on this as well. You know, this is something that has been worrying me, that a lot of time in this modern day, we always like to pathologize things. Like, for example, you know, talking about time anxiety, people do have time anxiety in different points in their life. It's just now that once it's a term, you know, we coined, then suddenly everyone was like, oh no, I have time anxiety, so I have to be diagnosed. And the other part is because there's a lot of push, either from clients or from, you know, the modern clinical world, to always make sure that we're looking at the client in a way that's, you know, what is the client's issue right now? What is the problem? So now psychologists and psychiatrists are pushed to diagnose people. And sometimes this happens without, you know, careful examination. So we just diagnose everyone with everything, right? And this can become a problem. And in a way, when we talk about diagnosing anxiety, at least with the manuals that we have, at least with what we have right now as a clinician, it really, if you're going to be diagnosed with certain types of anxiety, because if we look through the anxiety section of the manual, there's a lot of anxiety. Like, we're talking about phobias, we're talking about PTSD, we're talking about generalized anxiety. Generalized anxiety can come as time anxiety as well. There's always that component as well. And, you know, you have separation anxiety for children. So there's a lot of that. So there's a lot of symptoms or criteria, we call, that we need to tease out to see whether or not this person is fully, we can't fully diagnose them. But another thing that I think everyone should be clear is that diagnosis is not the end all be all, right? When someone comes to therapy, well, it depends. Someone just want to be like diagnosed, then that's fine. But most people, I would say, coming to the therapy room or come to the psychiatry room, they don't just want to be like diagnosed. They want their symptoms to be, you know, fixed, right? So the diagnosis is just a way to summarize what's going on and have like a clear understanding of what can happen, right? And it is also an important tool for doctors to communicate with each other. For example, if I were to tell another psychiatrist that my client needs help, I can just simply say they have generalized anxiety disorder without having to put in every single symptoms, right? So it's easier to communicate. But the thing is, the symptoms are what's important, right? Even if you're not diagnosed with something, doesn't mean you don't have that symptom. So it's not as if you're not diagnosed, then you don't have an issue with certain things. If you say that, then that person would be like, okay, so now what's wrong with me? But then if we are diagnosed, but we never look at the symptoms, then, okay, I have diagnosis, then what? What should I do now? So I think we can look at the diagnosis as something that makes communication easier. It's almost like, you know, when we talk about movies or something, we talk about tropes or cliches, right? So it's just a simple term for us to be able to understand the general idea of what's going on. But the symptoms themselves need to be, you know, worked through with the client. And that's more important than anything else, I think.
Hmm. And what can you do? Can you actually fix those symptoms?
Oh, totally. I mean, like, person, if you're talking about a person, you know, okay, let's just put the diagnosis that a lot of people, you know, talk about unfixable. Okay, I'm air quoting here. So, you know, disorders such as ADHD or disorders such as schizophrenia, you can alleviate the symptoms, right? So for example, there is a difference in how people with ADHD brain works with people who don't have ADHD, right? The symptoms manifest in different ways for people with ADHD, but it doesn't mean that they cannot fix it. Fixing is not the point sometimes, you know? It's just alleviating the symptoms, right? people with ADHD, then that would mean that they have to go through different kind of strategies, different kind of skills they need to learn to be able to function well. And that's the point, functioning well. So in anxiety, what happened is once we diagnose, then sometimes they're just left hanging in the air, right? They don't even know, okay, so I have this diagnosed, what should I do next? A lot of time, anxiety and depression are very, like, again, I air quote, very fixable, because, you know, there are proponents who are talking about that it's in the brain function, right? Some people are just born that way, to worry, to be depressed, right? Even though it's not as popular now, the thought is not as popular now, but there is a biological component to it. So it's not like you can fix your brain that you're born with, but you can certainly fix the symptoms, right? For example, if you are having a lot of anxiety about certain things, then maybe if we can look at what's actually causing that thing that you're worrying about, and we help you go through that, then the symptoms will be fixed, basically. So that's how I see the, when we talk about, you know, different kind of clinical diagnosis or clinical disorders.
You make it sound quite simple, but, you know, you talked about two extremes of people who struggle with anxiety related to time issues. So if we take a scenario of either one, right, and perhaps it's somebody who gets so anxious that they cannot even start on any tasks, and the more they worry, it's just this cycle. So what kind of strategies or skills would you be helping that person work with?
Okay, so for me, of course, for people who may not be as who may not be familiar with therapy, right? Therapists comes in from different approaches, so different therapists may use different approaches to fix a certain issue. One of the things that I always do is that I always use social focus approach. So that's how I help my client, using the approach, the principles of solution focused therapy. And when I see clients, for example, with anxiety, the main thing that I would look at is, you know, what are the things that they can do to alleviate the symptoms, you know? So it's going to be a little bit more different than people who are in cognitive behavior therapy approach. For example, they would ask about, okay, where is this thoughts coming from? You know, how can we change this thought pattern? So it really differs. And for me, usually what happened is, you know, I ask the client to come, and then we have a session. I examine things about their life, because again, just because you have time anxiety doesn't mean that the root of the problem is the same for everyone. There's going to be differences. And so just understanding that from the therapist perspective, and then work through that, through the approaches that we have, or at least the tools that we have, then we can slowly help the client, you know, look forward to a more productive future, I would say. Because a lot of times what happens is when the client comes, they're just stuck with certain issues that they don't have different perspective on it. Right? So I think this can be a very valuable time for the client to really think about, you know, what's going on and how they can, you know, help themselves.
And when it comes to the tomorrow or the future, and the even the existential time anxiety, and that's really worrying about things that are beyond our control. We can't see the future. Who's to tell us what is this idea of our purpose in life? What's the psychology behind this? Why do some people get more anxious about this than others, to the point that it would affect their daily functioning?
I would say, again, there's a lot of different reasons that I can think of, right? Some people who are, you know, raised in a family who's always rushed. Some people, you know, have different things that they're looking forward to that might, you know, make them worry about whether or not they can meet that expectation. And I would say a lot of people have a lot of anxiety in terms of time and goal. It can also be traced back to how our modern social life is, right? We have social media, we have fast communication, right? So we're always in this way of comparing ourselves. Right? Before social media, let's say before the internet, people don't have people to compare with. They have their neighbors, they have their friends, and that's all. So they don't worry about a lot of things. They don't worry whether or not they get a new car, a new job, or that spouse that everyone have, right? Right. So it's almost like the way we are living right now exacerbate the issue, basically, right? So we have this ability to feel anxiety. And again, I want to just highlight here that our ability to feel anxiety is very, very important. It's a very human thing. And it keeps us from danger, but it keeps us from perceived danger. Let's say if I give an example, if you perceive that there's a snake in a bush, you would feel anxiety. Then you would avoid the bush together entirely. But for people who perhaps work with snakes or work with zoos, when they see a bush and they perceive there's a snake, they won't feel anxiety, they feel excited, right? So when we talk about perceived anxiety, we perceive things to be threatening. So now when we're at a stage where we're always comparing ourselves to others, or we're always thinking about the future, we're always, you know, when we talk about work, that 8 to 5 work, right? Punching in, punching out, there's like this constant need for us to check on time, whether or not we're having enough time to do things. So this really creates this kind of society where we always need to be doing something, or we think we always need to be doing something and achieve something, that we don't even have time to just think about our own selves, right? They don't even want to have like big goals, but they are forced to have those kind of things. And now they are put in a position where they don't have the skills to do it, they don't have to want to do it, but they have to do it, and now there's like stress over it, right? So they have this anxiety about whether or not I'm able to do it while time is passing. So all the small things really culminates in a way we perceive our life and our world right now, that I really think is the reason why a lot more people are having anxiety, not just time anxiety. A lot of people are having a lot of anxieties these days, and it actually worries me as a therapist.
So do you think we're too far gone to try and reset that thinking? And, working with mental health professionals to learn strategies and skills through therapy, would that be one of the things that you try to get people to look at, to explore, and to then see, you know, is this expectation why I'm thinking and feeling like this?
Yeah, that's the main, I guess, the main work as a therapist is to help people. And hopefully, just from my own view, right, if I'm able to help one person and they're able to solve that issue and they learn from it, really, really learn from it, that means that their children or their next generation, their friends, their neighbors, their family can have the same access to the same skills because they can teach that, right? So that can change a lot of things in that small community, right? So I'm always optimistic in a way, so I don't think that we're too far gone, but to be able to change certain situation, we have to have a lot of understanding of the problem, and also have to have a lot of self-accountability, right? So we can't just complain about certain things and just, you know, this is how the world works. So there's need a sense of responsibility of, you know, changing ourselves and changing, you know, the world around us. And having that sense of purpose, I think, is very, very important, you know, when we talk about time anxiety as well. Because sometimes what happens is we put the purpose that we put is unrealistic, unattainable, and sometimes not even helpful.
Oh, it's
right?
Defined by someone else.
Yes, it defines by someone else. I want that new car. And I think that that would make me happy. So I feel like at an age of 33, I need to have that new car, right? And they feel that that's the thing that they need to have. So they strive towards this purpose, and then now they're 33, they're stressed, but they have that new car. But then suddenly, people have newer cars. So now they're anxious about that. So it's kind of like a purpose that doesn't really help anyone, not even themselves. You know, sometimes if you look around you, people just need transport. That's the main reason why you need a car, not exactly that particular specific type of car, right? It's just that exaggerated situation. But the idea is sometimes we put our purpose in a way that's not helpful for us, which causes us a lot of anxiety because it's, again, unattainable, unrealistic. Or even once we reach that, then we become stressed because we found out that that's not exactly what we want. We want something else. And then we feel like we wasted a lot of time from before.
So I just want to wrap up by tying back to what you said earlier about the concern that people may misuse certain terms related to mental health and over-pathologize our feelings or our struggles. Everything may be a disorder without linking it to what you could do to improve your situation. So I guess just to wrap up, coming back to this term or this notion of time anxiety, how do you want people to understand it and to look at how it could change things for them?
Well, I guess the best way I would say is that we can use the terms, but we have to use the term with, we have to have knowledge about the things that we're using, right? We can't just use whatever is popular, you know, and have no understanding of it and incorporate it in our lives. For example, you know, basically people are just not allowed to be people anymore. You know, you're not allowed to feel sad. You always have to feel happy. I have this love-hate relationship with the terms, you know, it's okay not to be okay. Well, on one side, I do like it because, you know, people go through things. If you just lost a parent, for example, you're not depressed. You're not clinically depressed, you're just going through grief. And that's normal. People have to go through that. And it's, this is like kind of like a, something that I experience from time to time as my work as a clinical psychologist, because there are clients who came by, you know, having all this list of medication. But the thing is, they're just worried about really real things that's happening in their life, or they're sad about really real things in their lives. So it's almost as if we're not allowing people to be people anymore, you know, pathologizing every single thing. And the hate thing is also because of this pathologizing. And this, it's okay not to be okay, can also be understood as, you know, since I'm not okay, then I'm not going to do anything about it.
Yes.
Yeah, so that can be a really big problem as well, since you're already pathologizing this thing. Okay, I have time anxiety, so that's just that.
And to hide behind that and
never
do anything. Yeah.
Yeah, so that's where the danger, where we use this kind of terms just willy-nilly without really thinking about what it can mean. Right? And even, I think, me personally as a clinical psychologist, there is a push from APA, for example, American Psychological Association. So they are the big board that basically determines the direction of the clinical psychology work, right? All the therapy work, for example. So they push for newer terms to be used, you know, diagnosis newer things where, you know, sometimes it may not be necessary. As people, as a society, we have to be very careful, you know, understanding, yes, this is something that you can use to describe what you're feeling so that it's easier for you to communicate. But you cannot, like you said, right, you cannot hide with that, and you cannot hide behind that and say, you know, I cannot change things. These are just terms. These are just things that we go through, that we collectively use to explain certain things, but it's not exactly being clinically diagnosed with anything or anything. So if you understand correctly what I'm trying to explain,
Yeah. What I get is that even with a diagnosis, and like you said, a term helps everyone better understand what you're going through. But we're looking at outcomes as well, helping you manage it and be able to get back to some sort of normal function of your life. All right. Thank you so much for speaking to me today. I've been talking to Anum Sophia Mohammad Fazli, clinical psychologist from Thrive Well, about time anxiety, but also about recognizing anxiety generally and how to work with yourself, with your support system, and with mental health professionals to find strategies and skills to manage these issues. You've been listening to Health and Living on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.